Welcome to another Saturday night at the Vancouver Institute. It's a rather inclement day, and as a reward for the many faithful who've come out today, we have coffee and cookies out in the corridor afterwards, and when you can meet with the speaker and ask more questions. We do that from time to time, and I think this is a particularly good time to do it. Today we have an interesting evening, a celebration of Vancouver. There's much to celebrate, and let me begin with something that you can celebrate in Vancouver, namely the Vancouver Institute. I want you, as we're listening tonight to how our city will develop, to remember that Vancouver is not Toronto. That is, Vancouver is a place where you have options, where on a Saturday night, you don't have to mindlessly sit in front of a TV set watching the second hockey game. You can actually go out and listen to ideas. And that will be true as long as so many of you appropriately express your affection to the people who are outside collecting memberships for the Vancouver Institute. You do that. We want you to continue to do that. And as you're thinking tonight about the ideas you hear, remember that the Vancouver Institute is something very special that makes Vancouver what it is. And so please, please pay attention to those people out in the hall. And particularly as you're enjoying your coffee and tea and cookies. Tonight we have Chuck Davis, who has been involved in almost every form of the media in Vancouver. And he's written books about Vancouver, and all of us have heard him in many different ways. We're going to hear him tonight talking about Vancouver. His lecture is called Today Vancouver, Tomorrow Everything. Chuck Davis.
You will be delighted to learn, those of you who came to hear about the internet aspect of my talk tonight, that the technical element will be minimal, because I am a computer klutz, and I have people like Robert Craig from Stratford Technologies to help me. I'm going to keep my talk rather basic, but I have, I think, some interesting things to tell you about the evolution of a book that we're doing, my little company, and also a rather, I think, awesome internet, I don't even know what to call it. I'll wait until I get to that part of the talk. I have on the walls of my workspace at home two photographs that I think typify what I'm about. One is a photograph taken back in the 1800s of a fellow named James Murray, who was the original editor of the Oxford English Dictionary and a personal hero of mine. He is standing in a metal shed, which he built himself in the backyard of his home, and he's holding onto a book and a small slip of paper. Around him, on every wall, are thousands and thousands of little pigeonholes, and in each one of those pigeonholes are tiny little slips of paper about words, words in the English language. And this man, his story is really fascinating. It's written about in a book that I heartily recommend called Caught in the Web of Words, written by his granddaughter, Elizabeth Murray, and it tells how he put the initial pages, the initial volumes of this 13-volume work together. It took years and years, and in fact, he died before it was finished. Below the picture of James Murray is a photograph of a fellow holding a CD-ROM, a single CD-ROM, and it contains all of the Oxford English Dictionary. Now, instead of 13 volumes, there are 26. And the whole thing is on one small CD. So with that in mind, what I'm going to tell you about later tonight, after I talk a little bit about this book, it's called the Linkman File. 10 years ago, it would have seemed insanely ambitious. Now it's only semi-insanely ambitious. By the way, one of the elements in that book is an illustration of one of the pages that Murray wrote in tiny crab handwriting. It's the beginning of the letter H, the etymology of the symbol itself, and the first few words in the H section of the library. And it's in his handwriting. I went to my copy of the Oxford. I have the entire, this is the old version, the 13 volumes. And I went to volume 5, which is where the H's start, and I opened it up, and I looked on that first printed page, and there are his words. And it was oddly thrilling, in a way that I know some of you will recognize, to see that these words written by a human being turned into this monument of the English language, the Oxford English Dictionary. And so it's that excitement that I feel when I look at the kind of projects that we're doing in the Linkman Press. Behind those words was a person. And behind the words in this new book we're doing are something like 213 persons. We have an incredible galaxy of writers, and virtually every person whose byline you've seen in Vancouver is represented in this book. In fact, on the table outside, there's a book by Michael Kluckner. He's one of our writers, written several pieces for us in the book. And Robin Ward has a book out there. Robin Ward designed our book. And I think you'll find it quite a nice, clean, modular, and very condensed design. The book, by the way, is 906 pages. It should be out by the middle of December. We are trying very, very hard to have it out before Christmas. It's not linked to Christmas. It's not a gift. Well, no, I shouldn't say it's not a gift book. Don't want to kill sales. But it's not a book that is necessary to be bought before Christmas, because it's got all kinds of stuff. Let me give you, just share with you some tiny statistics about the book. 906 pages, 213 writers, 210 sponsors. Let me explain, there's no advertising in the book, but to finance it, we went around to local business and said, please sponsor an article. And at the bottom of the page, they have a few words about the history of their own company. If we hadn't done that, the book would have cost about $105 to $120. And we thought that might harm sales just a tad. There are hundreds of photographs in the book and thousands of index entries. In fact, my last assignment before the book goes to press is to do the index myself. We could have hired an index professional, but we've run out of money. This book is incredibly expensive. The writing fees alone are $250,000. So we couldn't go that way. And it all started, this whole thing started, because I'm a list freak. I am, well, I won't say obsessed by lists, but I'm very fond of them. When I was a kid, I used to make lists. I made lists of the tallest mountains, the longest rivers, the fattest people, all sorts of lists, lists and lists and lists. One day my dad said, Charlie, one of these days, you're going to make a list of all your lists. There it is, 20 years ago. So another one of the elements that oddly enough led to the creation of this behemoth of a book is the fact that I am not a neat person. If you saw my workspace at home, the word neat would not spring to mind. It's a rather large room, and it's crammed with filing cabinets and books and papers, file folders, all sorts of junk. I haven't seen the carpet in years. And a friend who saw this space said it reminded her of the world's largest gerbil nest. So I am not neat. And oddly enough, that led, in a way, to the creation of this book. I came across a quote a couple of months ago during a trip to New York. Visited the New York Reference Library and found this quote by A.A. Milne, and I just love it. He said, one of the advantages of being disorderly is that one is constantly making exciting discoveries. And boy, that just resonated so wonderfully. Because I made an exciting discovery about 20 years ago, a little over 20 years ago, that I'll tell you about because it led to all this. When I get an idea, I tend to write it down, where I was, what time of day, etc., and then I throw it in a drawer and forget about it. That's precisely what I did with this case. I had this idea and I started looking around for a piece of paper, I've got to write this down quickly, and I couldn't find one, so I grabbed a piece of paper that already had something on it, tore off a tiny corner, and wrote this idea down, threw it in a drawer, and forgot about it. 8 years later, I found that little slip of paper, 1975, and it said, should do urban almanac on Vancouver. And I looked at it and I said, yeah, I should. So I did. And thanks to a fellow named Ernie Fladell at the Social Planning Department, City of Vancouver, they financed this or arranged the financing. This book happened. 20 years ago, 500 pages, about 80 writers, and it looked at the city in a depth that had never been attempted before. All sorts of stuff missing. And when I say depth, I don't mean it's a serious book, it's not academic, it just gives a lot of facts. I am a fact freak. So that led, as I say, to that book, and that's an entirely separate story of its own. Since then, I've done several other books, Top Dog, History of CKNW, The Centennial History of North Vancouver District, a textbook that's in all elementary schools in BC called Turn On to Canada, social studies text. By the way, in that book is a tracing of two little hands, and those are my daughter's hands. She was in grade 3 at the time. That was just a coincidence that she was in the same grade I was writing for, so I was able to throw all my ideas at her, and I like puns, so if I told her a pun and she groaned, I put it in. But anyway, when I got the CKNW assignment, every book has its own story, and this is the story of this new one. When I got the CKNW assignment, I happened to have just bought myself a fancy new computer with a 386 processor, tons of memory, and because I'm a klutz, I didn't know how to run it. The only thing I could figure out to do with it was to play a game that had two gorillas throwing exploding bananas at each other. And I got very good at this game, but I thought, well, this is silly. I've spent $4,000 to watch two gorillas throwing exploding bananas at each other. This does not compute. Well, so I went back to my standard procedure of writing, which is to do it all in longhand. I've done a lot of books in longhand. Then I type it up, then I retype it, etc. Dumb, but I couldn't figure out any other way around it. Well, and then one day, I got some what I'll call junk mail. Now, I'm thinking that if I ever write an autobiography, I'm going to call it Junk Mail Changed My Life. Since then, I now look at junk mail. And I'm sorry, John, I'm speaking now to my partner, John Coughlin, my business partner, because he's the one who sent out the junk mail. He and his wife, Kathy, run a company called Kara Data Center, and they're computer consultants. So one day, while I'm doing the CKNW stuff, I get a sheet of paper and, you know, the catalogs, the usual stuff, and in the middle of it is this garish orange slip of paper that says something about computer consulting, and they're about 6 blocks away. So I called them, explained my problem. They show up on the doorstep the next morning, and in 24 hours, I'm up and running. I finished the book on the computer. It decoupled my speed. Is there such a word? And it was just marvelous to be able to do it so quickly. Well, during the course of working on this thing, Kathy and John and I developed a kind of rapport. We liked working with each other. And also, they're very good at what I'm very bad at, and vice versa. Technically, I'm a klutz. They're very good. I'm disorganized. They're organized. It was a lovely marriage made in heaven. And one day, Kathy said those fateful words, why don't you do the Vancouver book again? Now, I have been asked over the last 20 years, conservatively speaking, 1,000 times, are you ever going to do the Vancouver book again, bring it up to date? And I never did. But they said, the Coughlins said, we'll help you. We'll even financially back you. So here we are, 3 years later. And by the way, speaking of that, let me read you a portion of the introduction to the book. I think you might find this a little interesting. Tomorrow, there will be 110 more residents in Greater Vancouver than there are today. Since we began work on this book 3 years ago, the population of the Vancouver metropolitan area has increased by more than 120,000. And demographers tell us that by the year 2001, there will be 2 million of us. Works out to about 40,000 people a year. And that rapidly growing population, many of its members newcomers and unfamiliar with the city, is one of the reasons that Linkman Press is publishing this book. Let me explain that name, Linkman Press. It's not a person, and it's not, oddly enough, linked to the links that we're familiar now with internet technology, where one site will link you to another. Now, it turns out that in this case, a link is a torch. Back in the days before street lighting in England, they had people called link boys and link men who, for a few pennies, would light your way home. If you came out of a party or a dance or whatever, these fellows would light their torches, their links, and guide you home. And I always thought, like, came across a note the other day that I had this idea about 9 years ago. Wouldn't it be nice to have a publishing company called Linkman, whose books light your way with all these facts? That's why Linkman Press. It's the word link boy appears in Pepys's diary back in the 1600s. And the last reference in the OED is 1898. So link boys and link men were around for 300 years, and we've revive the tradition. Then, coincident with this huge book, I was also doing a column at the Province. It was what they call an items column. Three dots, boldface names, that kind of thing. Gossipy, sort of second-class Jack Wasserman kind of thing. And in that respect, I want to tell you a story that relates to my daughter. This happened some years ago, but I've never forgotten it. My daughter was about yay big at this time, Stephanie, and I'm walking her to school, and on the way there, one of her little classmates came out of her house and joined us. So the three of us are walking along, and this other little kid looks up at me and says, "Is your name Chuck Davis?" And I said, "Yes." And she said, "Do you write for the newspaper?" And I said, "Yes." And she said, "Why?" So I'm walking along, and good question. It's when they started asking the same question at the paper later I got worried. But what happened was that my interest and the answer to this question came about during a trip across the Burrard Bridge. Now, we've all walked or driven across that bridge hundreds and hundreds of times, thousands. It's been around since 1932. But one day I'm driving across it, and for the first time I thought, who did all this stuff? Who did those busts of George Vancouver and Harry Burrard, the coats of arms, the torches at the north end of the bridge, the flame of peace at the south? Who did all this stuff? And it happens that the city archives is quite close to the south end of the bridge. So I'm not sure if I did at the same time drive right over there and look. It's possible. But I eventually got to the archives, and I started looking up this material on the Burrard Bridge. Now, this is back in around 1977. And I got hooked reading this stuff and visiting that fabulous place, the city archives. How many of you have been to the city archives? I see a hand. Oh, how nice. How nice that so many of you have been. This is a wonderful place. Thanks to Major James Skit Matthews, the terrible-tempered Major Matthews, we have this wonderful treasure trove of stories and photographs, etc. The fact is, however, that Major Matthews was like me. He was disorganized. He was a terrible archivist because he, well, I'll explain it this way. They have a kind of love-hate relationship down at the archives regarding Matthews. They love him because he collected everything, and they hate him because he collected everything. And there's no order to it at all. They're still finding stuff and trying to figure out how to categorize it. He had this weird system. But what he did, bless his marvelous soul, was collect everything, and it's all there. And that's what's important. And in fact, he had a lovely phrase. I tried to find it. I asked the archives people to look for it too. We couldn't find it because of his system. He describes the archivist as following in the train of history and picking up the scraps of paper and other paraphernalia that have been dropped. And that image is just so wonderful. And I'll tell you another thing about Major Matthews that's interesting. He has a trunk full of secret stuff. And he left instructions that it not be opened until 50 years after his death. He died in 1970, which means that this trunk won't be opened until 2020. And I'm determined to live to 2020 so I can see what's in that trunk. I can hardly wait. So as I say, I go to the archives and I get really hooked on this stuff. And I ended up doing not just one column, but 196, and stopped only because the province went from broadsheet to tab, and when they went to tab, the history column went. It didn't fit in with the new format. So I started doing other stuff. But I think one of the reasons that that column worked, because people really did respond to it, is one that I love doing it, and I think they could tell that. I was crazy about this stuff. And the second was that I couldn't tell the difference between the trivial and the important. Or to put it in another way, I could tell the difference, but to me they were equally interesting. So it didn't matter whether it was a big subject or a small subject, I found it fascinating. For example, on October 6, 1909, Vancouver's first motorized ambulance is taken out for a test drive and runs over and kills an American tourist. Now that, to me, that's got to get into the book. Important? No, but... And then another. Now this is... This, to me, is a real discovery. I was reading something some years ago about the Galeano expedition, the second tour by the Spaniards in this area, 1792, and came across a really fascinating reference to, and it's in the Spanish journals, to being met by some local native people who brought them gifts of salmon. The Spaniards gave them the usual beads and trinkets, but they also, because I think there's a reference in there that they detected that the native people were not exactly overwhelmed by this stuff, they also taught them a song. It happened to be a song that in 1792 was a big hit in Europe. It was on all the charts. It was a French tune called Mel Brook. More specifically, Mel Brook, s'en vont à guerre. Mel Brook has gone to war. And I see I'm supposed to have had it in here, and I don't. So I will rectify that right now. I went to the CBC record library. I was doing some work for them at the time, on the faint hope that there might be a recording of this thing. And sure enough, there was on an old BBC recording. So thanks to Karen Wilson and Karen Eng at CBC, I had this recording. When I first heard it, I should mention, the journals say that as the men rode away from the meeting the Spaniards, they were singing this new song. And here's what it sounds like. So, that's all. Just that little bit. This image of those people, those native men rowing away singing for he's a jolly good fellow, is one that just sticks in my mind and I think adds to the color of learning about the history of this city. Now, I had another thing that I brought. Unfortunately, I goofed. This is my mistake. I had a copy of the movie Casablanca. I forgot to mention until the last minute today that it wasn't on VHS, it was on Beta. They had a couple of Beta machines here, but neither of them worked because they haven't been used for so long. And I wanted to show you a clip from Casablanca, which you've all seen, and probably like me a dozen times, because there's a Vancouver-born actor in it. His name is John Quaylen. Can I see a show of hands from movie freaks? How many people would know John Quaylen if they saw his picture? Oh dear, what a shame, because if you saw this guy, you'd know right away. He was in 100 movies back in the 40s. He played the doctor, the father of the Dion quintuplets in those movies they made about the Dion quintuplets. He played Muley in The Grapes of Wrath. In Casablanca, the next time you watch this, there's a famous scene where Victor Laszlo and Ilse Lund first come into Rick's, and you know, see Sam at the piano, and he sees Ilse, and he realizes, oh, we got a problem here. Ilse looks at Sam, and she thinks, oh, where there's Sam, there's Rick. And then we cut to a scene of John Quaylen, and he is with the Underground, as is Victor Laszlo. And he goes over to the table, pretending that he wants to interest them in buying a ring. And he shows them the ring, and Laszlo isn't interested, but then he pops up the ring, and there's the symbol of the French Resistance. And Laszlo says, oh yes, I'm very interested. Next time you see that movie, watch for the guy with the ring, John Quaylen, born in Vancouver. And the reason I mention that is because later I'm going to tell you something interesting about Quaylen. So anyway, while doing that series of columns, I had this thought, why don't I do a Hall of Fame, not a building, just a list of names of people who've had an impact on the city? And I thought, how to start? So what I did was to go to all the book-length histories of Vancouver and find the people whose names were in all the indexes, on the theory that if you had made the index of every book about the history of Vancouver, you would obviously have had an impact. So I did. And then I found about 35 names. You had to be dead. I found about 35 names. And then I further ranked them according to the number of entries. Now, what was curious about this list, there were 35 names, what was curious is that it was extremely imbalanced. There were no women, there were no Native Indians, there were no Orientals, there were no East Indians. It was virtually, with the exception of David Oppenheimer, who was Jewish and who was our second mayor, it was people like me and most of you, Anglo-Saxons. And I thought, this ain't right. We've got to redress this imbalance. We've got to bring out more people, increase the names. So one of the very first things that I did when I determined that we would have a Hall of Fame, or that we would be doing this big new book. Oh, by the way, here it is. This is the dummy of the Greater Vancouver book. This is what it'll look like. The design may be slightly different, but that's the heft of it. It's rather big. And when I determined that we were going to do this, I thought one of the things we're going to have in there is a Hall of Fame that is more representative. And you get people, for example, like Lily Lavrock, one of my favorite Vancouverites, long dead. How many people here have heard of Lily Lavrock? Well, that's actually not bad, because most of you, I had never heard of the lady until I stumbled across her doing some research. She was the first woman to be a reporter in Vancouver. In 1909, she founded the Vancouver branch of the Canadian Women's Press Club. In 1921, she launched something called Celebrity Concerts. And she was sort of the Hugh Pickett or David Y.H. Louie or now the Tina Vanderheiden of her day. She brought in people like, it's an astonishing list, Fritz Kreisler, Yasha Heifetz, Nellie Melba, Beniamino Gigli, Pablo Casals, the Ballet Russe de Monte Carlo, Maurice Ravel as a pianist. An astonishing, and like 20 years, and nobody knows about her anymore. So we're going to rescue her from obscurity. There's also a wonderful fellow, and I'd like to do a movie about this guy, Gustav Konstantin von Alvensleben. A wonderful character, just fabulous. I'll tell you one story about him, there are 100. When he first came here, he started painting barns out in the Fraser Valley and repairing fish nets. He shot birds out in the valley and brought them in and sold them at the back door of the Vancouver Club for 35 cents. And one of the lovely stories in Vancouver's history is Alvo telling of how the demeanor of the head waiter who bought the birds from him changed so dramatically when he switched from coming in the back door selling birds to coming in the front door as a member. All of a sudden he was getting kowtowed, and you know, it was quite exciting. I'll tell you one other story because this is irresistible. This guy's, it's a fabulous life. He started getting involved in real estate and eventually turned out to have the biggest fortune in British Columbia. He was the richest guy in BC for a while. He was eventually not allowed to come back into the country because of suspicions of being a German spy in the years of the opening of the First World War. But he put an ad, his first full-page ad, in the Vancouver province announcing some real estate properties. His English was terrible. His spelling was bad. The province made the mistake of correcting his copy. So they ran the ad, and he came in the next day, and he said something like, 999, das ist nicht, was ich geschrieben haben. I don't know if I said that right, but that's what he said. And you must print what I gave you. And so they printed what he gave them. So he got two ads for the price of one, and it made him a sensation. And there's all kinds of other stuff. It's a fascinating story. Listen to this one. This is from the Hall of Fame that will appear in the book, which was incidentally written by Constance Brissenden and Larry Loye, and there they are. And they have done a marvelous job. What we have here in the book is 500 mini biographies of people from the city's past. And some of them you're not going to know about. For example, Zheng Jin Cao, inventor of a Chinese perpetual calendar, born circa 1889, Canton, China, died October 2, 1948, Vancouver. Taught math in a Chinese high school for 2 years. In the 1930s, ran a restaurant. Active in the Chinese Benevolent Society, elected president in 1939. Grandmaster Chinese Freemasons, superintendent of Kuang Chi Chinese School. As a youth, he began analyzing a possible Chinese perpetual calendar, eventually developing one from 1 BC to 9999 AD, the first of its kind. I'm assuming, by the way, that his calendar didn't start with the words 1 BC, it'd be the equivalent of it. A copy of the calendar was presented to the Vancouver Archives in 1937, and he was also the publisher of the Chinese Times from 1940 to 1948. I'd never heard of him. Now I know that in our past we had a man who invented a Chinese perpetual calendar. It just adds a little bit of flavor to the city. And here's this reference to John Quaylen, that actor that I told you about in Casablanca. And here's what I really love about this story. He was born in Vancouver, December 8, 1899, died September 12, 1987 in Los Angeles. His father, Olaus Peter Quallen, was pastor of the first Scandinavian church on Prior Street from 1898 to 1900. And then it goes on about his movies. Now, his last movie, by the way, was in 1973. It was called Frasier, the Sensuous Lion. I don't know. Now, the lovely thing about this is that the next time you see Casablanca, and this comes up, if there's a friend with you, you can say, oh yes, this fellow was born in Vancouver. His father used to be a Lutheran minister here. And I said earlier, this business about the, you know, the trivial stuff and the important stuff. You may have seen this in the Sun's City Limits page recently. I've been feeding them some stuff, but in the event that you didn't see it, this is the kind of story that I do love, besides the important stuff. Back in around 1909, an actor named William Pratt came here from, or rather an aspiring actor, came here from England. He was about 23 years old, and he tried to get a job with a touring acting company in Kamloops. He might have done a little bit, but it didn't really work out. So he came down to Vancouver and got a job as a laborer, building what became the PNE. Then he tried selling real estate for a while, and eventually he gave that up, moved down to Hollywood, changed his name to Boris Karloff, and became a big movie star. Now, the fact that Frankenstein's monster helped to build the PNE is, to me, just a really, I see him with a hammer and saw. He was a very tall guy, by the way, Boris Karloff. He's about 6'3". So in this book of all of these lists, stuff like hundreds of events, a woman named Hilary Blair, a mature student at SFU, has put together a chronology of thousands of events over the city's, over the greater Vancouver area's past 150 or 60 years. Oh, by the way, I must show you. This was made up for me by John Coughlin tonight. We are, as you can see, very high tech. What this illustrates, this simple little stick here, is something quite remarkable about the book. Think of this stick as representing the length of human occupation in this area. This little white space at the end is us. All of this is Native Indian. We devote in the book something like maybe, what, 10 pages, John? If that, to this, and the rest of it is this. There's a lot more to be done. I find that humbling. But I also thought this would be a good way to show it to you graphically. So, lists. We have more than 200 movies listed in this book. Michael Walsh has written this incredible compilation that gives all the feature movies made here, gives their cast, who the director was, what year was made, and a short summary of the plot. We have the 500 name Hall of Fame. We've got an article, hundreds of firsts, the first doctor, the first car, the first this, the first that. We have more than 60 tourist attractions. We have, in fact, a book that is far smaller than it should be. At 906 pages, that sounds perhaps faintly ridiculous, but the fact is that if this book were as long as I wanted it to be, it would probably be about 3,000 pages long. It is just astonishing the amount of information in this city. Here's an example. Ellen Twigg, who does BC Book World and one of the real champions of literature in this area, we asked him to do a list for us of writers in Vancouver, Greater Vancouver, past and present, and a short bibliography, listing of their books. We allotted 10 pages of small print, and this is a big book, so it's about 1,000 words a page. He gave us, with the exception of three or four writers who are no longer with us, like George Woodcock and Malcolm Lowry, he gave us only a list of the living authors and their books. And it would have taken up 60 pages. It turns out there are more than 1,000 people in Greater Vancouver right now who have written books. We had no idea. So the 60 pages had to be cut down to 10. And I can tell you that that was extraordinarily painful. I even had to cut out a couple of friends. Max Wyman, the premier dance writer in this country, we asked him for 1,400 words on the history of dance in Vancouver, equivalent to two pages in the book. He gave us 4,000. and they were 4,000 very good words. A sign of a good article is that you have trouble cutting it. We looked at this thing and we could not figure out how to cut it. So we had to send it back to Max and say, Max, you've got to cut it. And he said, thanks for spoiling my weekend, but he did do it, and he sent us the 1,400 words. Now, I'm happy to say that one of the earliest decisions we made when we started putting this book together was that it would also become a CD-ROM. The CD-ROM is going to have all the stuff that didn't get into the book, but it's not going to be out for quite a while, so buy the book. Oh, by the way, I must tell you that we noticed at the very last minute a typographical error that would have been a classic had it escaped us, and I'll share it with you now. The Vancouver Chamber Choir, led by its founder, conductor, music director, John Washburn, was formed in 1971 as one of Canada's two professional choirs and immediately made an impact. In 1973, it was the first Canadian choir to ever win a first place award in the prestigious BBC competition, Let the People Sin. Boy, are we glad we caught that one. Anyway, besides the CD-ROM, we also made an early determination that this book should be on the internet. Not in its entirety, but simply as a kind of sampling of what you could see on the book. It may eventually, down the road, be in there in its entirety, because I really like the notion of everybody being able to share this stuff, but at the moment, we're just going to be doing it in sort of a sampling arrangement. And happily, we didn't have to go looking for somebody. Somebody came looking for us. About, what was it, Rob? A month ago, a month and a half, 2 months ago, somewhere around there. A fellow named Robert Craig, president of Stratford Technologies, came to see us and said, we've been hearing about this book and we'd like to put it on the internet. And we sat him down and we had a coffee and it is happening. The book is now, portions of it, is now on the internet. And if you want to write down the URL, is it a URL for going into, is that correct phrase? I don't want to get this followed up. It's discovervancouver, all one word, .com. Is it that simple? Discovervancouver.com. Now, I am not, as I say, technically skilled, and I'm not going to try to describe to you what you will see on this thing. I'm going to let Robert Craig do that. This will be about, he tells me it's only about 45 minutes. He was kidding. This will be about 10 minutes long. I think you're going to find it interesting. You'll see what the book site and his own site looks like on the net. And you'll also see a rather unique way of looking at a building, the Sinclair Center. This is, I think, going to interest you. Here's Robert Craig.
Good evening, everyone. I must say I'm certainly pleased to be here tonight talking about my favorite subject, which is the internet. As many of you know, the internet is growing at a phenomenal rate. 1 million people sign up to the internet each month. That's 1 million new people. There are about 60 million people around the world using the internet on a regular basis. And this figure is expected to double within the year. So for me to say that the internet is growing at a phenomenal rate is quite possibly an understatement. Those of you who have used the internet will know that at times it can be a little chaotic. I think that's okay, though. You're going to get a little chaos when you empower millions of people with the ability to publish information that they feel is relevant and they feel is important. It's been said, and I agree, that the internet has everything in the world that you want, everything in the world that you want, plus everything in the world that you don't want. I don't know about you, but there's a lot more things in this world that I don't want than things that I want. This evening, I'm going to give you a glimpse of a project that we've been working on at Stratford Internet Technologies for about 1 year now. The project's called Discover Vancouver. Discover Vancouver is a place on the internet, a place in cyberspace, if you will, that we have carved out for the city of Vancouver and surrounding areas, for the people of Vancouver and surrounding areas. And I'm going to give you a glimpse of that now. If I can have Brad Moore, who works up with me, come up and... And if we could turn the lights down a little bit. As you can see, the Discover Vancouver site is aesthetically pleasing to look at, like the city of Vancouver itself. One of the features we have on this site is our directory of businesses and activities. Here you can find any one of the 50,000 businesses we have listed on our directory simply by typing in the business name. Businesses can also be found by category or subject. As an example, Restaurants Vancouver will bring up all the restaurants located in Vancouver. We allow you to be geographically specific. As an example, Japanese food restaurants, Robson Street. We'll list all the Japanese food restaurants located on Robson Street. Or inexpensive lawyers, Granville Street. Well, that research would result in nothing because there's no expensive lawyers in Granville Street. Another one of the features we have to our site is our extensive maps of the downtown area. As you can see, we've divided downtown into 9 different sections, or districts as we call them, including Stanley Park. You can visit a district simply by clicking on it. And here Brad will bring us into the hotel district, where we have outlined and detailed all the buildings, heritage buildings, all of the new buildings, all of the buildings located in that particular part of Vancouver. We've also labeled all the streets. This screen can function as a simple map that can be printed out. It also functions as a directory. We list all the businesses located in that part of Vancouver, and you can visit these businesses simply by clicking on the city block. So when Brad clicks on this city block, we'll bring up all the businesses located in that city block, in this case, Hastings Street West 900 block. You'll see at the top of this screen, we've highlighted 2 businesses. These are businesses that have commissioned us to expand the information on their company. So rather than be represented by a simple name, address, and telephone number, we expand this information. In the case of Menorah Gold, we have 5 or 6 sections that outline the activities of that company. So this site can be used to find specific businesses, or it can also be used to explore different parts of Vancouver. You can go cruising up Robson Street, shopping up Robson Street, exploring the different restaurants and shops located on Robson Street simply by going from city block to city block. You can look for a specific business. As an example, if you were looking to just to see if there's a post office in Sinclair Center, we would bring you into Sinclair Center. Sinclair Center is a site that we're very proud of. The federal government commissioned us to do this site. We're proud of this. Debuts some cutting-edge technology with regard to the internet called QuickTime Virtual Reality. QuickTime Virtual Reality will actually allow us to bring you right inside the mall. Here you see a floor plan of Sinclair Center, and when we want to visit a different part, we click on the node. By clicking on the node, what this technology will allow us to do is go right into Sinclair Center. Here we're now inside the mall, and if I want to pan right, I can pan right. If I want to pan left, I can pan left. I can turn 360 degrees around. I can zoom in and zoom out, and I can look up and I can look down. I want to emphasize that this technology is ubiquitous in the internet. Anywhere in the world you're able to see, come and visit Sinclair Center, you need to have internet access and a computer. So far I've talked a lot about the functionality of our site, but we don't want Discover Vancouver just to be simply functional. We want it to be interesting, we want it to be educational and entertaining. So we include features like our tourist attractions, which will allow you to visit the different points of interest in and around Vancouver and the Lower Mainland. You can visit a point of interest, and in many cases we'll have pictures and diagrams and read about this particular site. Our goal at Stratford is to design this site so people come back and they visit on a regular basis. We feel we're on track with this goal with our latest addition, the Internet Coffee Break with Chuck Davis. The Internet Coffee Break is a series of articles that we will publish on a weekly basis. These articles are interesting stories and anecdotes about Vancouver, the history of Vancouver, historical figures in Vancouver. The first article that we're publishing is The Birth of Vancouver Streets, which is just a delightful article about the origins of Vancouver streets and Vancouver street names. Most of these articles are about a page or a page and a half long, so they're something that can be read right at your computer terminal or printed out to be read later. We also feature the Greater Vancouver Book quite extensively in our site. There's a lot of synergy between the Greater Vancouver Book, the content of the Greater Vancouver Book, and what we're trying to achieve with the Discover Vancouver site. We want people to be able to peruse this book or check this book out in the comfort of their home or at their office rather than standing in a bookstore. So we include an overview of the book. The fact that there's over 200 writers in the book and it consists of 19 chapters. We allow you to visit the table of contents. So you can go right into the table of contents and see the titles of all the different chapters. You're able to go right into a particular chapter where we outline the titles of each article located in that chapter. And in the case of transportation, we have a sample article. Railways in Greater Vancouver by David Mitchell. And here you can read a sample article and get a real feel for what this book is all about in favor of this book. If you're interested in the writer David Mitchell, we include a brief autobiography, and in this case a picture because he's very handsome. And at this point, we feel that there will be a significant number of people that are interested in ordering the book, purchasing the book, so we have online ordering capabilities. In closing, I would just like to encourage everyone to visit the Discover Vancouver site. We're having a lot of activity there. In the month of September, we had 66,000 hits at our site. In the month of November, we had 80,000. So there's a lot of people coming into our site and reading about it. I encourage all of you to do that and read the articles on the Internet Coffee Break because they are a lot of fun and they are entertaining. And check out the Greater Vancouver Book. It's an interesting way to peruse a book. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Rob. Incidentally, what Rob showed you was contained within his laptop. It wasn't real time. And my suspicion is that when you hit the internet looking for this, it won't come up quite as quickly as you've seen here, but it has all that material. And in fact, one thing he didn't show was David Mitchell's actual article on the history of railroads locally. By the way, John Coughlin had an absolutely marvelous idea that I know will make writers happy. When we get all the book on the, or rather portions of the book onto the net, each of the writers, where appropriate, will have what's called a hyperlink. So that if you wanted to find out, for example, what else Constance writes about, and if her name is highlighted, you can click on it, and it will show her picture and the kind of thing she writes about. And then you can contact her and say, please write us something or other. So, in effect, it's a kind of way of making writers more well-known in the area. Now, every book, as I've said, has its own story. And one of the stories in this particular book is rather unusual. It has to do with a piece of music. I was at a meeting of the Friends of the Archives about a year and a half, 2 years ago, and this is a group that gets together to further the aims of the archives. And two of the people there were Bruce McDonald, who's one of the writers in our book, and his wife, Gail McDermott. And before or after the meeting, I forget which, we were chatting about nothing in particular. And I said, you know, one of the things, one of the ambitions I've always had is to go to a composer and say, write me a symphony or a concerto. Well, they had this fantasy. And Gail thought I was talking about the project. And she said that would be a nice way to launch the book. And I sort of, yeah. And within 24 hours, I'd gone to see Michael Conway Baker in North Vancouver, the composer, whose work includes the soundtrack for Grey Fox, the Bill Miner movie. He wrote the music that opened GM Place. He wrote the music that accompanied Queen Elizabeth's invitation to the world to visit Expo 86. He wrote Washington Square, a fabulous ballet that was recently resurrected in Toronto. His music is very melodic, very accessible, and I went to see him and I said, Michael, I'm bringing out this big book and I'd like to have a piece of music to commemorate it. And I said, I'm fond of the concerto form and I really love the oboe, so let's make it an oboe concerto. And he said, okay. And then later, during our conversation, and again, not related to this specifically, I said, hey, I used to be a CBC announcer, and one of the things I remember, and you'll know as a musician, the answer to this, when Bach was active, some of the composers who followed him wrote music based on the letters of his name, B-A-C-H, those four notes. And I said, I never knew what H was. And he said, that's German notation. What they call H, we call B natural. And I said, well, in that case, I want the first three notes of this concerto to be my initials. C-H-D. C, B natural, D. And he said, okay. He has an electric piano in his living room, and he went behind it, hit the three notes, and then he started improvising. I swear to God, I got goosebumps. It was quite lovely. The result was that last October, the Vancouver Symphony Orchestra at the Orpheum Theater, in what was supposed to be the launch of the book, we are rather late, played Vancouver Variations. And I'm going to play a portion of it for you tonight. It's about 23 minutes long. I'm only going to play the first portion, which is someone walking around the city. In fact, Michael said it's supposed to be me. And when he said he thought of me walking around the city, he thought of the A&W root beer. And I said, thanks a lot. By the way, when I first met John, I said, I get a lot of ideas when I eat. And he sort of gave me the once over and he said, you apparently get a lot of ideas. So I hope I have this set up correctly. If I do, what you will hear is the first of the opening movement of Vancouver Variations, and the first three notes of the initials of the music are the first three notes of the oboe plays are my initials. And I can tell you, hearing a 40-piece orchestra play your initials gives you a buzz. So it's 2.5 minutes long, and I think Michael has done a marvelous job. These CDs, by the way, here's the sales pitch time, are on sale out on the table out front. And there's also cassettes. So I hope I have this, got it the wrong way around again. And again, there's a bit of blank tape at the beginning. But this is the Vancouver CBC Orchestra. Thanks to Karen Wilson and Karen Eng for arranging this. And by the way, this will be played on the CBC. That's not it. That's another piece of music. Do we have... I think I goofed. I'm gonna put this one in and rewind it. I hate when this stuff happens. I'm so bad at this. Rewind. Where's rewind? Don't you hate when stuff like this happens? John, let's open up another one. I'll vamp for time. Oh, dear. I'm sorry. Because there's other music on here as well. Michael Conway Baker wrote the music for Dorothy Hamill's Ice Capades. He's in the Orpheum Theater tonight with the VSO. They're playing a composition of his that he wrote some years ago called Through Lion's Gate. And one of its movements, The Mountains, is goosebump music. He writes a lot of goosebump music. I think, and I'm not just saying this because it's connected with the book, I think this music is goosebump music. He has a definite melodic skill. And his wife, Penny Baker, makes the best cinnamon buns I have ever tasted. While John's getting another one of those, I'll talk to you about another aspect of the book. This led to something else called the Linkman File. You are the first to hear in detail of what the Linkman File is. Have we got it there?
Yeah, we're not sure what side it is.
Okay. Fingers crossed. This was recorded last April at the Orpheum Theater. Yep, this is it. Two and a half minutes. That's pretty stuff. And I want to tell you that if it's followed by a visit to Chinatown, to UBC, various other places in the city, you hear the bells of Holy Rosary Cathedral. Michael asked me to tell him some of the favorite places I have in Vancouver. I mentioned UBC as one. There's a fugue in there which has an academic flavor. And I said one of the reasons that I liked coming out to UBC was that I quite often would meet people at the faculty club, the long-lamented faculty club, and I said, I loved sitting in the foyer of the faculty club and watching the people come in because so many of them looked so weird. A lot of you are very colorful people. So, To get back to the, oh, by the way, the cassettes and CD-ROMs, to be crassly commercial, are on sale outside. $12 for the cassette and $20 for the CD-ROM. Sorry about that. I don't know if sales pitches are part of this thing, but I really like that music so much. Let me tell you about the Linkman file, and I'm running way over, so I'll keep this quick. When I think of all of the elements of this book and my own particular interest in every subject, and I mean every subject, I have an insatiable curiosity about everything, it all kind of coalesced into this idea for a file which I originally called Everything. What I want on the net is a file called Everything. And people say, well, what kind of stuff would be on it? And I say, everything. And I mean everything. If you want to know who lived at 1423 Mustafa Boulevard in Constantinople in 1747, it would be in there. Now, it's going to take, obviously, an incredible amount of time and people, etc., to get this to happen, and it's certainly not going to happen in our lifetimes. But if I could encapsulate the thing in a question that George Lois, the American ad man, once said, he said, what's the big idea? The big idea is this: to permit anyone, anywhere, to get the answer to any question at any time. If it's legally publishable, in other words, if the copyright is expired, and if it meets the standards of local decency, it will be on this file. And you can look up anything. And I find that one of the frustrations of working on the internet now and looking up a specific piece of information is that it tends to be in these discrete bits. I think of it as an incredibly long, infinitely long succession of index cards. And let me tell you how I am going to begin it. I'm going to begin it with the Linkman file, Vancouver, or perhaps Greater Vancouver. Our aim, and we're already starting, is to have 10,000 entries. And what that would mean is that you could go to this Linkman file, Vancouver, and ask anything, and presumably it would be on there. May I have a suggestion for a subject? Just blurt out anything. The first traffic light. Okay, that's an excellent one. What you would do is you would go to this file and you'd probably put in something like traffic light, comma, first, or whatever. And then you would find out one of the things that really drives me crazy. It turns out there are two versions of the first traffic light. They're both 1928, but one's at Carolyn Hastings and the other's at Main and Hastings. I'm so glad you mentioned that subject, because that one I was familiar with. So you do get this kind of reaction in this file that you get in the other ones, that there are these varying descriptions. There's all kinds of discrepancies about dates, etc. Did I see another hand?
The first livery stable.
The first livery stable, my recollection is that we do not have that. However, if you know about it, it would get in there. Now, let me tell you, I'm really running over, but I just got to tell you this thing, how this started. I'm surfing the microfiche. I'm sitting at a microfiche reader looking at past stories about Vancouver, and here I had a kind of what James Joyce calls an epiphany, an insight into what you can get into. I came across a story, let's say it was in the 20s, I'm inventing now, but the story is true. It made reference to a reshuffling of the administration of the Vancouver Police Department. There was some kind of a mini scandal. Later that same day, hunched over the same machine, but now a couple of decades away, I came across an almost identical story. 20, 30 years later, a reshuffling of the administration of the Vancouver City Police Department. And I thought, of course, this kind of thing happens over and over again. And I came up with this idea for everything, and here's how it works. Envision a person sitting at a console of a computer and entering every word that has been in every newspaper in Vancouver since day one. Now, I say entering every word. The reason I don't say scanning is because When you look back at the early newspapers, and believe me, I've spent hours doing this, they are not in any condition that is scannable. You eventually get to the point where you can actually start scanning the stuff, but forget it in the early years, that I actually have to sit there, squint at the screen, and type every single word. And when I say every single word, I mean right down to the classified ads. Let me tell you why. During the Depression years, I'm looking through one of these newspapers, and I came across a couple of want ads that I have never forgotten. One was put in by a fellow who wanted to borrow $30, and he would pay it back $5 a month for 7 months. Another one was put in by a 16-year-old girl who had just had a baby and wanted to put it up for adoption. Those two little classified ads, out of hundreds in that day's paper, give a kind of color, an insight into that era that some of the stories on the front page don't. If it's all there, then you can find it. I had Shirley Barnett call me. She's with the family that runs the Elephant and Castle chain of restaurants. She asked me to find out about a restaurant called Rosie's that existed back in the, I think, 20s, 30s, because they were going to open a restaurant. It's the one now by the Rosedale Hotel. And I went back and found it. I do this, I don't know what you call this system, where you've got a rough idea of where it is, so you go 5 years ahead, 5 years back, and you start doing this until finally you found it. And I found them, found out who ran it, where they lived, all that stuff, sent it off, and they used it. This kind of stuff will be multiplied a thousandfold when you can have all this material there. And believe me, if it's there, you will want to use it. You will think, where did Uncle Harry live in 1938? Was it on Burrard, or did he live over? You look in this thing, and there it is. By the way, let me quickly give a plug. Get your pencils out, those of you who are on the internet, because I'm going to give you the URL for the city's webpage, City of Vancouver. It's a marvelous, marvelous page. 400 plus pages of stuff about the city, just marvelous stuff. I mean, administrative, most of it, you know, permits and licenses, noise pollution, that kind of stuff. But it's a marvelous site. Scott McCrae at City Hall deserves a lot of credit for this. http://www.city.vancouver.bc.ca. One of the things I discovered in there is that they have a program of selling you, or maybe even giving you, worms to be used for composting. You can go and get 500 worms from them. And I discovered that worms have five hearts. Love finding out stuff like that. And the internet is also going to be a source for future books by Linkman Press, John and me. And I'll close by telling you about one book we want to do, International Humor. I can't think of a better source than the internet for doing a book on international humor, because all the jokes are in there. You just have to find them. On that theory, I sat down the other day and I entered in, just randomly picked, jokes plus Hungary. And I got this terrific story. It turns out that during the days when the Communist Party was running Hungary, they still are, it's a different name now, same people apparently, but when they were running the country, there was a joke going around in Hungary at the time, and it went like this, that if you could get a new, if you were a member of the party, if you were able to sign up a new member, you could resign the party within a year. If you were able to sign up two members, you could resign immediately. And if you were able to get five new members, you got a card stating that you yourself had never been a member. Now that's just a, and I got that off the internet. Now imagine pages and pages of that kind of stuff. It's going to be great. I wanted to tell you about a filing system that I'd come up with, which is quite wonderful, but I can't, no time. But I do have a little bit of a closing peroration here, that everyone born somewhere in Greater Vancouver, or who like me is from outside, originally Winnipeg, more than 50 years ago, will find this book useful and entertaining. Hundreds of people were involved in it, and their collective experience and their researches far exceed the knowledge that any one person could have. I came here as a kid more than 50 years ago, and have written extensively about it since. Yet in the 3 years that I've been working on this book, thanks to the more than 200 writers involved in it, I've made incredible discoveries about this city. There's much more to this city and its surroundings than you can imagine. And I hope that the Greater Vancouver book, which we expect to see in the stores, God, we hope to see it in the stores by the middle of December, will satisfy a lot of those cravings. Thank you very much.
Will you take any questions?
Okay. We'll have our usual question period. I ask you to keep your questions short. We don't want comments, we want questions. You want to start?
Yes. Based on the wealth of knowledge you have, would you tell us a little of your hopes for the city of Vancouver?
It's Dr. Clark, isn't it?
Yes.
He was on my radio show umpty-ump years ago. So was Judge Nemeth. So was half the people in this room, I think. I have to tell you, I have to confess that I am not a contemplative person.
Repeat the question.
Oh, I'm sorry, yes. The question from Dr. Clark is, what are my hopes and aspirations for the future of Vancouver? I don't think in those terms. I'm a reporter. I don't have the smarts that are essential for me to look ahead and predict what's going to happen. In fact, my inclination to do that is tempered by a book I have at home called The Experts Speak. You must get this book. It's wonderful. It's filled with hundreds and hundreds of predictions made by people that didn't come true. And it's wonderfully funny. I'm no good at it. I'm not going to attempt to... I can tell you that I do find it exciting. It doesn't disturb me that the Oriental population of the city is increasing. It doesn't disturb me that traffic is getting more and more. I tend to like clutter. I like noise. I like busyness. When I was in Tokyo some years ago, and standing in the middle of that incredible continent of a city, and at one corner, and I looked, there's a building 5 floors high, and on every floor was a different restaurant, and the streets were packed, and I would walk down one street, and there'd be a smaller street there and a smaller street, and there's no zoning. You'd find a Buddhist temple next to a grocery store, next to a kid's school. It was just incredible chaos. I loved it. I came home and said to my wife, listen, we're moving to Tokyo, at least for a couple of years, and she reminded me we had a 5-year-old daughter, and it might not be a good idea. So I'm sorry, I can't really answer that. That's not my... I don't do that. I just tell other people what I find out.
But Chuck, some reporters are allowed to think, you know.
Obviously, you check your book for accuracy. I'm interested to know if the book has any information about inaccuracies perpetrated by travel magazines.
Oh, this is good. The question is, the questioner asks, hopefully, that we've checked for accuracies. We've done our best, but are we going to dispel other inaccuracies that other books have perpetrated? I confess I'm guilty of one myself. I read somewhere that the green roof of the Hotel Vancouver got that color because workmen poured urine down the thing. And I discovered later that's not the case. And then 6 months ago, to my horror, there's an article by Don Hunter in The Province, and he quotes me with that story, and I'm, oh, my sins live after me. But I have to tell you that I came across an Oxford University Press book at Duthie's on West 10th the other day, and in the very first paragraph about Vancouver is a clanger. And I thought, boy, if the Oxford University Press can goof, so can we. We have something like 800,000 words in this book, thousands and thousands of facts. There will be inaccuracies, but we've got an awfully good crew. Robin Ward's designing it. A fellow named Julian Beder is our chief editor. We have about four editors, and Beder is an absolute nut about this kind of thing, and we think we're going to do pretty well, but mistakes are inevitable, and they will happen, and of course the book will start going out of date the minute that it appears, but the phone book goes out of date, 1,200 listings a day, and we still use it. Oh, gee, thank you for asking. I'm quite serious. This has changed my life. I'm serious.
What was the question?
The question was about my filing system. I was doing a little bit of bragging earlier about this filing system. It's incredibly simple. I have spent more than 50 years trying to figure out a way to organize my stuff. I've spent, I would conservatively estimate, 25% of my time looking for little pieces of paper. So here's how I solved that problem. That wasn't planned. What did I do with my notes? Well, there they are. That wasn't planned, honest. Okay. Last January, as I say, I write down all the times and dates I get this stuff. Last January, here's what I wrote. And this is the exact, I took it right off the screen. Pick up a piece of paper from this desk. Put it into a file folder marked number one. Pick up another piece of paper. Put it in a file folder marked number two. Pick up another piece of paper. Put it in a file folder marked number three. You with me so far? Yeah, and so on and so on. When you come across a piece of paper that is like an earlier piece, add it to the folder in which that earlier piece was placed. Then, and here's the important point, describe each piece of paper and give the file folder number it was put into. So I put this on the screen. I have 860 file folders so far, and let me tell you what has happened. John came around to the house the other day when I was raving about this thing. I said, you've got to come over and see what it's doing. And I said, ask me anything. And he said, okay, we're planning a book on Gastown. Give me your notes on the Gastown book. I go to the computer, sit down, Gastown book. Zip, 853. Hand it to him, and he said, he had to sit down. He couldn't believe it. In fact, he and Kathy gave me a card that is sort of like that Milne quote I gave you earlier. It said, one of the joys that people with neat desks never experience is the joy of finding something that was lost forever. And now I can find stuff. So that's the filing system. It's extremely simple, but boy, it's effective. Public art. I bumped into Elizabeth Godley on the street yesterday near Duthie's on...
Question.
Thank you, Eric. The question was, can I say something about the public art on Beach, etc., in that area? Off the top of my head, the only one I can think of is that Joe Forty's fountain, which has an interesting story behind it. But I bumped into Elizabeth Godley yesterday. She asked me that question that all the writers ask who worked on the book, that great literary question, when do we get paid? But I said, Elizabeth, I must tell you, the book's coming out in about 3 or 4 weeks. She's the one who wrote the article on public art, and it's about, 10 pages long? There's all kinds of stuff. Every monument in downtown Vancouver, all the statues, who did it, when it was done. So I can't answer you now, Pauline, but the book will.
Friends of some of these people, when you see an error, get in touch with me or in the workshop, okay? Because I want, we're actually bringing the Hall of Fame out as a separate book with photographs of as many of the people as we can a year down the road. And in an expanded version, now I'd like to make sure that the entries are 100% accurate. So that, regarding your question on accuracy, it is really tough to get some information.
Constance, in fact, like me, shares a fondness for getting the exact dates of births and deaths of people. It helps in research, and as she has said, we are going to take her 500 names, and she's going to expand to about 1,000 people. We're going to expand the annotations and add some pictures, and in about a year, we will have a book on past notables in Greater Vancouver that I think will knock your socks off.
Constance, if one wants to get into the book, one has to die, is that correct?
That's right.
However, living people do get in. One of the advantages of the book being late is that we were able to mention the appointment of Dr. Martha Piper as the new president of UBC effective next July. So she's in the book.
Other questions? Well, before we wind up the evening...
There's one more, I guess. It's Constance Brissenden. Brissenden.
Any other questions? Well, I'm going to, before we ask Professor Robert McDonald to thank our speaker, just a few quick comments. I'm going to remind you again that as you go out, you can purchase whatever you like, but I ask you also to really pay some attention to those people who are trying to help the Institute along. You know, it counts on voluntary membership. It's very, very cheap to keep us going. Let me also say that we have if you sign up now, you'll get very early notice of our season after Christmas. Among the very first speakers after Christmas will be UBC's new president, Martha Piper, who we just mentioned. And of course, we have, as I mentioned last week, we're going to have that new author, Mike Harcourt, coming and talking about his book.
Who is that again?
And so we have a variety of interesting talks after Christmas. And the second comment I want to make is that we have today for all of you who come out on such a wintry night, coffee and tea and cookies out after this talk. And Chuck will be there to show you his filing system and many other facts that you won't be able to have and to talk with you about it. And Constance and the others will be there too, I hope. You can get more information from them. I'll now ask Professor Robert McDonald to come and thank our speaker.
I have been studying Vancouver history and working in the archives for many a year. And Chuck, I didn't know about that story of Major Matthews' chest with all the goodies that's going to open in 2020. So if you're going to be there, Chuck, damn it, so am I. Should be fun. I've often thought that in my teaching of BC history and Vancouver history, if my students had half of the enthusiasm for the subject that Chuck Davis shows, that we would fill volumes with both information and insight about the province and the city. It's quite remarkable. It's a cliche, in effect, to say that Vancouver is going through a transition, that it's a changing place, and it's certainly far different from the Vancouver that I visited as a youth in 1956, when you could come to a crosswalk and put your hand out and the cars would stop. It's exciting, of course, because of the ethnic change. It's excited because of the scale, the Grizzlies, the fact that you can now take an airplane direct to New York. And, of course, along with that comes the downside of crime and traffic and so forth. But it is a city that's growing up and changing fundamentally. And what's interesting as well is that not only is the city changing, but intellectual inquiry about that city is changing. There's an amazing amount of work being done about Vancouver, from creative writers to anthropologists, sociologists, historians, and indeed a good portion of that is not being done by academic specialists, but by people of different disciplines and various interests. And of those others, and indeed perhaps the single most important, and one of the most important of the whole group is Chuck Davis. I really have used his Vancouver book many times, some of you have undoubtedly as well, simply for the fact that it does something important. It pulls together basic information about the city and indeed about who we are. And the new book that's coming out will do that in spades. It will do it for another generation. And what excites me about the book is that the two together will be a useful tool for us to chart the development of the city. What we're seeing here, it seems to me, both in this broader range of work and in Chuck's work in particular, is a process by which Vancouverites are defining themselves. And I think that the Vancouver book, now with the new Greater Vancouver book, that process of definition is being accelerated significantly. So Chuck, for your greater general work in the field and for your stimulating talk tonight, on behalf of those here today, let me say thank you very much, and may your book sell a million copies.
Thank you very much. Next week, the last lecture of the series of Before Christmas, Professor Cairns about the survival of Canada. That'll be a very important evening for all of us.